on trial for your life, the eyes and the ears of the nation on every word you say. Who wouldn't break down? Tonight on Banfield, crying under oath. Kyle Rittenhouse isn't the first to sob on the stand, but juries are pretty good at reading between the tears. Plus, what the heck is wrong with us? A record year of violence in the sky, so you'd think the number of prosecutions would make your head spin. And you'd have to think again. And then, toxic tabloids. Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, says gossip magazines should come with warning labels, just like cigarettes. But really, would that change a thing? Hello and welcome to Banfield. Usually the emotional climax of a murder trial comes at the end and begins with "we, the jury." And that'll be the case in Kenosha, Wisconsin, too, where a self-styled volunteer medic slash peacekeeper is on trial for shooting three men, two of them fatally, during street protests a year ago. Kyle Rittenhouse, now just 18 years old, faces an entire life in prison if convicted of the most serious charge against him, first-degree intentional homicide. And we'll find out soon enough if that's what he gets. But trials are like a roller coaster where emotions peak more than once, like when the defendant makes the excruciating decision to take the stand. And Rittenhouse did just that. And if you have not yet seen this, I want to play a few moments that will surely live in the hearts and the minds of the jurors, whether it sways their vote or not.
There were... There were three people right there.
Take a deep breath, Kyle.
That's what I... That's what I run.
Just take it. Time for our break anyway. You can just relax for a minute, sir. We're going to take a break.
And if trials are performances, that was a showstopper. Of course, people have cried on witness stands for as long as there have been trials. Some of them are acquitted. Many of them are not.
Ma'am, were you crying when you were shooting him?
I don't remember.
Were you crying when you were stabbing him?
I don't remember.
How about when you cut his throat? Were you crying then?
I don't know.
So take a look then. And you're the one that did this, right?
Yes.
At some point, did he do some other things to you?
And I was just standing in that kitchen saying, you know, Jesus Christ, I'm turning 42 years old. And I've been put through this bullshit since I was 35. 7 years of my life wasted.
Jared, did you love life?
I love my son.
Have you ever had any ill will in your heart towards Blake, ever?
Never.
My experts have seen and heard it all. Mark O'Mara is a familiar face on this program, a criminal defense and civil rights attorney based in Florida.
Here.
Ronald Beaton is a jury consultant and president of Trial Behavior Consulting in San Francisco. Ron, I want to begin with you. You know juries, and that's your business. How do you think the jury was affected by what you saw with Kyle Rittenhouse today?
I think it was effective. It's a huge gamble taking the stand. You know, you can go back. You know, they considered putting O.J. on the stand, and they decided not to. Martha Stewart, they considered it, but decided not to. Here, what I saw and what I've heard, I think he was effective. I mean, it's a very narrow issue that I think he can have a real impact on, and that's his state of mind. And I think that might have been worth the gamble from what I saw.
So, Ron, when you're working with the defense attorneys in these cases, and I know you would work with both sides as well, but particularly defense attorneys, do you get a chance to look at a guy like Kyle in advance and give him the once-over and then advise the defense attorneys, do not put that guy on the stand? Or, you know something, this kid's going to turn it around. Is that your job? And would someone have coached these defense attorneys to say, Kyle, get your butt up on that stand and do your thing?
Yeah. I mean, typically they bring in an attorney who will cross-examine them and see how he stands up to cross. And that's we just saw today, wait till tomorrow and see what happens on the cross, because he's going to be crossed and that could be a different story. But I think from what I saw, I think he was effective. I think it was believable. I think from what I've seen, it'll cross demographic lines. I mean, I think the key is, I think men versus women will have different reactions. Young versus old will have different reactions. You know, somebody sees him as a grandson might find a lot of sympathy, might find it very credible, whereas somebody who's a peer, somebody who's 18 years old, 18-year-old men, I don't remember what the demographics of the jury were, but might call bullshit on it. So that's why it depends on the juror. But
I got to say, just look at that picture up close, because you can see the actual tear. And I have got to say that one of the first things I do in watching someone on the stand, and I can't even count how many defendants I have now watched on the stand, is I look for the actual water.
Yep.
Because it's one thing to play waterworks. It's another thing to see the actual tears. I don't know if the jurors could see it, but personally, from my assessment, this was no performance. This was no act. For me, it's very hard, and this will sound probably derogatory, and I don't mean it to. It's very hard to ugly cry. If you don't know what the kind of crying is that's believable and effective, that one is, because it's hard to act that out. And I just want to mention as well, Ron, you probably know I haven't asked Mark O'Mara a question yet. It's not because I don't like him. It's because his Zoom froze, and we're the gremlins over here are doing buttons and all the rest. So he will be back in a moment. But I want to show
Go ahead. Just say the discoloration of his skin, too. It's not only just the actual tears, but look at the discoloration. His cheeks, his nose. You can't make that up.
Yeah, you can't. You can't fake some of those automatic responses that come with an overwhelming emotional. It's like a vasovagal syncope of some kind, and I only know that because I've had it. But I want to play. Meryl Streep couldn't do it. You're right. She really couldn't. There's this moment that for me brought it all home years ago. It was, I think you'll agree once you see the next clip, it was the performance of a lifetime. And the jury said, effectively, she's full of it. Hogwash. It was Jodi Arias. Take a look at this.
So if he is being stabbed in the back, would you acknowledge at that point that he's no threat to you, right?
Objection calls for speculation.
Overruled. I don't know.
Well, if he's already been shot, according to you, and he's facing away from you, how could he possibly be any threat to you?
I could only guess. I don't know what you're asking me.
I was Sherlock Holmes with a giant magnifying glass on that trial for 17 days watching that face. And I struggled mightily to see any actual water come from her eyes. And maybe at some point she was upset because it sucks to be, you know, on trial for first-degree murder in a death penalty state. Mark O'Mara is back with us, Ron. I think we've actually been able to get his signal back up and running. I don't know if we have a picture of him, but look at that. What a face. Hello, my friend. It's nice to see you.
Great to see you.
You picked a fine time to have a Wi-Fi malfunction. Okay, Mark, did you see that thing with Jody? And did you hear the bits and pieces we were talking about before? Performances of a lifetime. Sometimes just for Jody, it was didn't work.
And normally they don't. Normally jurors see through it. But I will also tell you, in a case like this, when you're looking at this case, you know, we'll never get an opportunity to review this because it really seems like he's going to get acquitted. Not to prejudge the case, but the state has simply not proven their case. So did the crying help? I think it actually did. I think we said it was sort of more sincere than just that fake guffawing crying. But, you know, he's 18, facing the reality that he killed a couple of people and facing the reality he could spend the rest of his life in prison. I think it played pretty well in context of everything else, the weakness of the state's case primarily.
It's interesting you would say that. I wasn't even going to go there yet. Like, I was waiting a little bit. What I saw today, and I'm going to talk about this with both of you after the break, what I saw with the judge saying this whole mistrial business, I'm going to take it on advisement. I'm going to consider it. I am going to just put it out there. I feel like in the next few days, we're going to hear, you know, mistrial with prejudice. And I'm going to let you be law professor on this one, Mark. That little piece of with prejudice is massive. And a lot of people just kind of missed it. Could you explain why that was so massive?
Absolutely. A mistrial means you try the case again. A mistrial with prejudice means you've had your only shot at the defendant. The case is over and he cannot be tried again. In effect, what we learned in civics class is double jeopardy would have applied. Jeopardy has applied. He goes free. He cannot be tried again. What I think the judge is going to do, however, is let the case play out. We don't have that much more time. And see what the jury does. If the jury acquits, great. They get their good verdict. And if not, I think the judge may come back and say, we're trying it again, or I'm still not going to allow it to go forward.
I still want to go back to the crying for a moment, but not before I just mind the rest of this bit of business. The prosecutor's got a tongue lashing, and you're going to hear that in a moment. But I also wanted to know, if the judge decides on a mistrial, don't the prosecutors have another bite at the apple? Because they can argue about this judge, the tenor of the judge, the things the judge has said and done in pretrial hearings leading up to this particular incident today, which was an excoriation of the prosecution. Would they be able to fight that? Or once he said mistrial with prejudice, you're done. It's like you haven't got that option for double jeopardy.
Oh, yeah, mistrial with prejudice really cannot be appealed. The state could try some type of after-the-fact argument that it was a bad decision by the judge and should be reviewed, but which is why I think the judge is going to let the jury go forward, have their verdict. Very well going to be, it seems like an acquittal is a good chance, and then the judge protects everything from this potential mistrial with prejudice. But I will tell you, if the judge says mistrial with prejudice, Rittenhouse will not be tried again.
Yeah, that's a big, big, big little piece of language that dangled after that. I'll consider it mistrial. Okay, Ron, about the crying part again, because again, I watch this like a hawk. Every time a defendant, first of all, decides to take the stand, I do jumping jacks and backflips because we just don't get it very much. And then when they do, I watch every single flinch. And I wondered, you know, especially since you work so closely with so many different attorneys, you don't have to say who. Have you ever had an attorney question you as to whether they should counsel their client to cry?
Yes. Yes.
What'd you tell them?
And no. You know, you're playing with fire. You give your client some advice, but when you start touching the trying to manipulate them like a puppet, it usually backfires. So I strongly discourage somebody trying to manufacture tears on the stand. It just doesn't work. People see through. I mean, especially anybody that's had children, you know, and not to pick out parents, but, you know, parents have seen the fake cry so many times that if you think you can get it past parents, good luck.
You got another thing coming. I am so with you on that one. I will also say this, out of that montage of people I showed you, including the Menendez boys and Jody Arias, only one prevailed. Only one got an acquittal, and it was that man at the end who was accused of killing his son. Okay, both of you, I want to ask you to stay there for a moment, because after the break, what on earth made the judge lose it, next level lose it in court today? And did he tip his hand on this case with his ringtone?
That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that.
Welcome back. We are talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Wisconsin. Mark O'Mara and Ron Beaton are still with me. Guys, the judge, Bruce Schroeder, he lost his cool today with prosecutors, and he was literally yelling from the bench. I thought it was shocking. I want you to take a look at it.
I was astonished when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence. That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that. And it gives... I'll leave it at that. So I don't know what you're up to. Just hours ago, I said I had heard nothing in this trial to change any of my rulings. So why?
Testimony, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
That was before the defense testimony.
Don't get brazen with me. You knew very well. You know very well that an attorney can't go into these types of areas when the judge has already ruled without asking outside the presence of the jury to do so. So don't give me that.
Okay, Mark and Ron, if that weren't enough, at one point today, the judge's phone rang in court, and it was not lost on anyone the song that he chose for his ringtone. Have a listen to this.
The actions that I had talked about were done in bad faith.
Proud to be an American where at least I can be free. Okay, so the reason I say that is not to be flip. It's because it's a song that's usually connected with right-wing politics. And so, Mark, if you add the song that rang out in court today and the excoriation of the prosecutors, plus the pretrial motions where the judge would not allow the prosecutors to call the dead men, in this case victims, but would allow the defense to call the people out on the street rioters, is that ammo at all for the prosecutors before perhaps there is this mistrial with prejudice, game over?
I think there is ammunition. I think you're absolutely right, Ashley. And I remember during the jury selection as well, some of the rulings that he was making. And I remember we talked about it, but some of just the way he was presenting just seemed to be very defense-oriented, very Rittenhouse-oriented. It was very concerning. The problem with all of this is, if they get their conviction, it doesn't matter whatever they did, whatever the judge did against the state. And if they do not get their conviction, if there's an acquittal, there is absolutely no right or remedy for the state to appeal any rulings, because the acquittal were to come to pass, ends the case completely. There is no other appeal. The state can do nothing about it.
Okay, Ron, quick question for you about something else that happened today. Is there a funny audio or is it just me? Can you guys hear that funny audio? I want to make sure that the audience can still hear. Okay. All right. It must just be me. I apologize. So it came to pass, and this was very worrisome to me for a number of reasons, that the jury, when they were being picked up at a bus stop or a stop where the jury bus was going to come and get them, it was discovered that someone was videotaping them. Now, that could be a tabloid magazine, could be a news cameraman who doesn't know the rules. It could also be somebody with nefarious purposes, because this is a very political trial. And it could be someone on the left and it could be someone on the right who is making a plan to make sure that this jury does what he or she wants. Ron, should we be worried about stalking? Should we be worried about what this does to the process for this already frightened jury who has said originally that they were worried before the trial?
Absolutely. I think you're right. The case is politicized, and these jurors noticed it. They notice everything. So I think they probably are very concerned. And you know, something I hadn't mentioned before, but you know, Mark mentioned about jury selection. The judge didn't allow juror questionnaires. This jury was picked in a half a day. They had openings, which is almost unheard of in a case with so much at stake. And so these jurors really did not get examined to the degree that we normally would see in a case of this magnitude. And then you throw this in.
Something? When I heard about this, I just want to say that jury duty is a civic duty, and all of us should do it. Do not ask me how to get out of jury duty. I will tell you to enlist in the Army, and you will get out of jury duty and serve your country that way. In jury duty, at least you can have a latte. But I want to say that it got us thinking to other people in civic service who have had this kind of garbage, right? And let me just run down a very short list. Adam Kinziger, a representative in Congress, got a voicemail telling him to slit his wrists. Okay. Congressman Don Bacon got an angry caller who said that he should fall down a staircase. And then this little gem was left on the voicemail of Michigan Congressman Fred Upton. Take a look at or take a listen to this. It's quite something.
Traitor. That's what you are. You're a piece of traitor. I hope you die. I hope everybody in your family dies. You piece of trash mother. Voted for dumb. You're stupider than he is. He can't even complete a sentence. You dumb mother traitor. Piece of mother. Piece of trash. Hope you die. Hope your family dies. Hope everybody in your staff dies.
So this is what we've become. Just a last quick comment from you, Mark. This is a political trial. These are jurors who are doing their civic duty. Should they have been sequestered?
I think so. I think we're getting to the point, particularly in these cases with social issues and political issues, and this is one of them, as is the Aubrey McMichael's case. Yeah, unfortunately, we're in the day and age where I think we should protect our jurors even more. We don't need their names out. We can sequester them. We can put them behind a two-way mirror or whatever we need to do. But yes, we have finally gotten to the point with social media and politicization of our society that now, in order to have people willing to serve, we're going to have to secure them.
And I don't know if that videotaping of them was anything, but we're watching that as well as the court is too. Mark O'Meara, Ron Beaton, thank you both so much. So appreciate it. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ashley.
Coming up, no space in the overhead bins. No space when the rude recline. And no safe space at 30,000 feet. Have we lost our collective minds? And what is keeping these nasty offenders from actually being locked up? Beware, Thanksgiving travel's coming. Welcome back. Meghan Markle takes on the tabloids and clickbait culture. She says the media and social media are in a race for the bottom, and they are dragging us all down with them. The Duchess of Sussex made the comments during a summit hosted by the New York Times. And the theme of the event was advancing women's equality. But here's what she said when the moderator, Andrew Ross Sorkin, asked her about her own leadership style, something he had read about.
I've read great things about you as a boss. And if you read the tabloids, you can read all sorts of crazy things about being a boss. Do you feel like you have to do it differently? And do you, specifically given your role, do you feel like you have to do it differently?
Well, firstly, I would urge you not to read tabloids because I don't think that's healthy for anyone. Hopefully one day they come with a warning label like cigarettes do, like this is toxic for your mental health.
Are tabloids really as toxic as cigarettes? With the increasing attention to our mental health, something Meghan and Harry have championed, do we need some kind of a warning label like that? I'm joined by Hilary Fordwitch. She's a British royal commentator, but she also has more than 30 years experience in business development and marketing. Hilary, you know, you could have looked at the answer that Meghan gave as tongue-in-cheek, but I kind of feel like she thinks that. I think a lot of people think that, too. Is there something to what she said?
Well, we can't get into the mind of Meghan Markle. It's a pleasure to be back with you, Ashley. But I would say, Ashley, the Wall Street Journal recently even ran a piece which was drawing analogies between actually Facebook and a lot of the online social media and the wars against the tobacco industries back in the 70s. And the legislation that came out of that with, in fact, warning signs on the packs of cigarettes. What we do know, actually, from, of course, that whistleblower at Facebook was most of these big online media companies, particularly Facebook, they know they are creating an addictive product, particularly for young people, just like the tobacco companies knew it. So as for Meghan Markle, I don't know whether she knows the science behind it or not. She certainly has leveraged and wanted to use the tabloids when it suited her, though.
So that, I mean, that's a really good point, and it's worth talking about that. And it's also worth talking about the name tabloid, and should anyone get mixed up, it's actually a newspaper you can open. A broadsheet is the one that, you know, like the New York Times, you have to unfold and then open up big. But I think we all kind of know she's talking about the, sort of the National Enquirer and maybe not like the Boston Herald or the Chicago Sun-Times that open right up the same way. But are they more vicious here in the U.S. or are they more vicious in the U.K.? Because Meghan sees both. She's back and forth.
Yes, actually, well, of course, all of that is a very subjective judgment call. I will say, though, the role of the tabloids, they often uncover things that the broadsheets never go near. And they uncover, you know, affairs of members of the royal family, even that, for example, the broadsheets don't. So I do think that there is a place for them. They're making money, and they're making money, though, as many people have thought over the ages, in a rather salacious way. But salacious news is what sells. Nobody's selling media by saying that, you know, people are going to work today and they're getting up and they're having their coffee and they're paying their taxes. So salacious sells, and that's what they base this on. What I would say is, in terms of either side of the Atlantic, in the UK, they don't let anything go, and they expect something from the royal family. They expect that the royal family serves, and the royal family is there to serve the nation. And I think that's something that she never really either understood, took the time to understand, and that's what she claimed. However, she recently just contradicted herself, because in the very interview that you mentioned, she also said that her husband, Prince Harry, talked about with great privilege comes responsibility. So now she's contradicted the very point that she didn't understand the royal family.
So I'm going to take a quick break here, Hillary, but I want you to stand by, if you will, because I sort of feel like George Washington is rolling in his grave right now. The word has come out that, you know, a royal sounded the early alarm about the January 6th rabble-rouser. So just imagine this irony, folks, with Prince Harry crying, "The Americans are coming." I'm going to explain all of that coming up. Welcome back to Banfield. Meghan Markle says tabloids are toxic and clickbait makes you cruel. I'm with royal watcher and marketing expert Hillary Fordwich. Okay, Hillary, I want to play this moment from Meghan's talk with the New York Times, in which she really said that scrolling through content turns us into bad people. Have a look at this.
Right now, if you're getting paid for the most clicks and you're getting more clicks when people are hate clicking on things, then without question, you are perpetuating a cycle, especially in the entire period of lockdown, right? Right. Lockdown, let's say someone before that had, I don't know, 5 hours a week that they could invest in just scrolling online. During lockdown and the absence of being out of the house or being at work, maybe you're spending 50 hours online. You're becoming indoctrinated. You're becoming conditioned to be cruel.
You know, Hillary, she gets vilified a lot, but I think she makes a lot of sense there.
Well, yes. The only thing I would say is that there's the assumption that you'd be cruel. Why couldn't you be really nice? Why couldn't you be really positive to all your friends and supportive? And when you see friends and family's material, be supportive. For example, on LinkedIn, we talked about business development-wise, marketing-wise. It's a great way to share positive content and to be supporting great causes and to see the great causes that other companies are sharing and to be very positive in the marketplace and in the business world. So I think she actually is coming from a very negative angle there. The other point I would make is, you know, I think one of the things that I don't think that either Meghan Markle or Prince Harry are considering, and you mentioned before the break about almost facetiously about, you know, George Washington maybe rolling in his grave. You know, in the US, it's not for me to say what Americans think, but generally, I don't know that there was a lot of animosity necessarily towards the royal family these days. 1 million Americans work for British companies, and 1 million British people work for American companies. So there's so much interaction and business across the Atlantic. And actually, one of the big concerns is they're almost stirring up this international animosity. Because to be pointing fingers both either sides of the Atlantic at the tabloids, or whether it's her pointing at the now the Instagram and all the different websites and saying that they're very negative, that's very negative thinking. And it's not good internationally. And it's not good for the royal family to be wading into anything. And she may say she's not a member of the royal family or think she's not, but she's sure using her title.
Yeah, okay, so we talked a little bit about the notion that George Washington could be rolling in his grave. I thought that because it was revealed to Wired magazine that Harry had been emailing with Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, and they'd been chit-chatting prior to January 6th, and in fact, Harry said that on January 5th, he warned Jack Dorsey that his platform could be actually used to, if you can believe it, maybe start a revolution or something of the sort. Have a look at how Harry put it.
Yes.
Jack and I were emailing each other prior to January the 6th, where I warned him that his platform was allowing a coup to be staged. That email was sent the day before, and then it happened, and I haven't heard from him since.
Harry was ghosted. I found the whole thing just so alarming to hear that a Brit was warning an American leader, so to speak, the Americans are coming, the Americans are coming. Didn't you find the irony in that?
Well, yes, it's ironic. And also what he was doing was thwarting protocol, royal protocol. He should know better that royals aren't to wade into domestic political issues. And that's what he's doing. If he was out to have any remaining titles from him stripped, he would be doing the right thing, because there's now been a great uprising, great disgust about this in the UK to have their titles stripped. Also, what's I think important to think about is the fact that what he didn't do was he didn't talk about Maxine Waters inciting violence and saying that it was quite okay to accost somebody in a restaurant or publicly, any kind of politician or anybody that you disagree with, you can go up and you can accost them. So what he's also done is he was picking a political side. So not only did he wade into politics, he was picking a political side. And I think that that doesn't sit well on both sides of the Atlantic. It's very polarizing, and it's not good for international relations.
You know what? I love talking to you. Your accent I could listen to forever, but you're just so darn smart. Hillary Fordrich, thank you. Good to see you again. So appreciate it.
Pleasure, Ashley.
Thank you as well, everyone, for watching. And if I didn't scare you too much with the social media business, I want to hear from you. So tweet me at TV Ashley. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook as well, Ashley Banfield. It's L-E-I-G-H. I know it's a weird spelling. I've lived with it all my life. But I do want to hear from you. And I do want to see you again tomorrow night right here on Banfield.